You are very welcome to Cawley's Call with me, Alan Cawley, powered by Benetti Menswear, a topical debate show covering all things Irish football, along with 1v1 interviews with top-class sports stars from a wide range of different sports.
It's me that's putting on the green jersey, me that's going to take flak from people to say, you're not even Irish. I was big enough to say, I'm going to take it.
There's many people I've spoke to, they always say, I used to put money on you scoring the first goal, but I've never seen any of that money, though.
And Andy, he says, I want the performances that I got from you in Scotland with you under 16s, not that rubbish that you gave me over in Oslo.
Hi everyone, and you're very welcome back to Series 2, Episode 30 of Cawley's Call. Delighted to have you with us again for another busy show. Thanks for the feedback on last week as well. Lots of messages in relation to the interview with Stephen McGuinness. We felt it was an important subject, not only because we know Stephen very well, but just in terms of the topic and the subject as well. And lots of people got in touch just to say they enjoyed it, and it's a very important message that we were sending out, which we feel it is also. Another brilliant guest lined up this week. And we're also going to preview the semi-finals of the Cup, which are obviously coming up, and also maybe look back on a couple of the interesting topics, I suppose, what went on with the football over the weekend. Of course, the Dublin Derby, Shamrock Rovers and Bows, and also the little bit of a fallout since that match as well, and that has been carried onto Twitter and online over the last few days. But before we get into all that, I just have to announce as well, we've been teasing you all along in terms of the live show. We did announce it last Thursday. This is our first podcast since we announced it. There's been a great reaction to it. There's 2/3 of the tickets sold, Stu, which is good news. We have 1/3 of the tickets left. They're available. The link is on my social media channels or also eventbrite.ie. You'll be able to just click in. Tickets are very, very cheap. A tenner a ticket. So if you haven't got your tickets yet, make sure you go on and purchase them, because we do have a brilliant night lined up. Obviously, the 3 League of Ireland managers. Kenny is coming in as well. We've another couple of guests to announce that we're going to announce over the next couple of weeks. And the biggest news of all, Stewie will be performing at halftime in the show. There you go, Stu.
I am now, am I?
I'm giving you the
Tell me this, if you're
stage.
Not on social media, what's the address to write to buy a ticket?
Eventbrite.ie.
Well, no, the actual physical address, send an envelope and a stamp. And
I'll give you my address after the show. Is that what you used to do in the olden days?
I'm going to go fucking back to doing that.
Okay.
Because they're a pain in my hole with social media. End of story.
I know.
And I'm going to predict it right now. You heard it here. We're all going to turn away from social media in the next year or two.
Right. Why?
Because it's a pain in your hole. Looking at the same shit all the time. Listening to the same shit all the time.
How long more do you give it? What's the longevity of Twitter and Instagram?
I don't know.
With the carry on out of people on it these days.
Yeah.
Can't have much of a shelf life.
It has to have its day. It has
Surely. When would people
just
say,
Bebo,
enough of this shit?
Yeah.
But anyway, never mind that, Stu. Great news about the show. Are you looking forward to it?
I am looking forward to it, yeah. I am, yeah.
Sugar Club.
How many songs am I doing? I'm doing two.
Two songs.
Yeah, I can't. I
have you decided which ones yet? Superstar has to be in there.
No, I'll do two, yeah. I'm going to do a cover.
Oh, interesting.
It's got to be very weird, but.
But we'll.
See, Sugar Club's very intimate, so you kind of have to do sort of an intimate thing. So.
We don't want people falling in love on the night. We want a bit of cracks, too.
I think you'll like this song.
Yeah, will I?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you can do one intimate one and one lively one. Sounds good? But for anybody, as I say, there was a great reaction to it, and we really appreciate that. It's something that we've wanted to do for a long time, since the first time me and Stewie actually sat down and discussed having a podcast. That was the first thing we said, that we'd love to maybe take it to a live venue. Of course, COVID fecked it all up for us, and we couldn't do it last year. So this has been on the cards for a long, long time, and we're absolutely delighted now. And of course, without Benetti Menswear, this wouldn't be happening either. So a massive thank you to them and to all involved there, because they do sponsor the show every week, and they're giving us a massive, massive help towards the live show as well. So we really appreciate that. But last little plug, my social media channels are eventbrite.ie, and hopefully by next week we'll be fully sold out. So get your tickets. Now, to this week's show, we've mentioned this man on the show many's a time.
You're so enthusiastic, do you know that?
Am I?
You're so enthusiastic.
I love it. I love it, Stu. This is my life.
Even when you announced Series 2, Episode 30, I was going to go, he's so enthusiastic.
I love it.
If that was me, I'd be going,
this is the highlight of my week.
Yeah.
And everything else, when I come in and see you.
Like, I'd be going, what fucking episode is this? Someone, please tell me.
But I'm enthusiastic about making a cup of tea, Stu.
Yeah.
So... But before we get, as I say, we have a brilliant guest, and we've mentioned this man on the show numerous times. His ears must be burning, because he's a friend of ours. We played with him, brilliant player, had a brilliant career. But he even went up on my estimation if he could, because of what Stephen McGuinness told us last week, and in terms of when he needed someone most, who was the person that was there for him, and even more so the fact that he travelled from England over here, stood in the garden, and basically just wanted to support Stephen and have a chat with his friend. And I thought it was absolutely amazing. And Alan Moore, you've gone up in my estimations, but you're very, very welcome to the show.
Thanks, lads. Thanks. Hey, by the way, that's a great idea, doing a live show.
Do you think so?
Especially now that... Ah, brilliant idea. Okay. Brilliant idea. Get people out, get live questions, and that's magnificent. Like that.
Okay,
I'll try and get over for that, I think.
I was going to say, will you book the flight, or will we book it for you? Because you'd be more than welcome.
Well, you'd be a guest.
On the stage.
If you want to come over, you'd be a guest.
Absolutely, he'd be on the show.
I'd love that. No, it sounds a great idea, especially with the way we've all been locked up for so long, just to get out and talk about football.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's sure, we love talking about football. That's all we do. That's our life. It's been your life.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, and you know you're a very humble person and you've already avoided it, but we did have your good friend on the show last week, Stephen. So I'm going to start right there. In terms of what Stephen was through, and I know you've had some issues yourself, different things, Morsey, over the years, but at what stage did you think, I'm going over to Stephen and I want to see my friend?
Listen, it's now a thing that's becoming more and more. And when you get older, you see cancer everywhere, and it's not good. But I was in contact as soon as I found out, and I was speaking to him when he was in the hospital and stuff. And I kept planning and sending him texts, because he didn't really want to speak on the phone a lot when he came out of hospital, and say, like, I'll be over next week. Do you fancy going for a walk out the Skerries and stuff? And he would always say yes, and then last minute he would pull out. So it got to a stage where I knew that he didn't want to see people. I kind of read the lines. I knew that he was isolating himself, and he was all for it in text. But it's so easy to say no in text with people like this, because I've done it when I was sort of depressed and stuff. I'd arranged loads of stuff, and it was so easy just by text just to blank people and say, oh, no. And you make an excuse, any excuse at the last minute, you know, just to duck over. And then I'd had enough of that. I'd had enough of being fobbed off. I kind of read the script and just said, right. So I went over and picked up Davey Kennedy, a good friend of ours, and just said, Davey, so I'm just going to sit in this drive. So we pulled up outside. We were there for about an hour, I'd say, maybe an hour and a half, sat in this drive just chatting. And we just wanted to get there and just be as normal as possible for him, to be honest. Mm. You know, because a lot of this stuff is ego. You know, you don't want people to see you sort of weak or whatever and stuff like that. So we're as good mates from years and years ago. So we just made sure it was as normal as possible. And he came out, and I've got to be honest, like I listened to him last week, and he said about sort of us saying, oh, you look great, but he did. And it was just our natural reaction is to say, like, Skip, you look great. I don't know what you're hiding away for. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was brilliant. And it was just like old times. We talked about sort of his stuff that he had going on and all the rest of it. We sat there for a couple of hours just chatting about old times and stuff like that. And it was just as normal could be. And that's all I knew from experience, that that's all I would have wanted. So that's what we tried to make it for him. You know, and we went away and we thought, like, we need to do this more. We need to get up there more and see him and stuff like that. But I didn't realise at the time, you know, it's only later that you realise what that's done for him. Mm. But I kind of knew that we had to sort of force the issue at some stage to say, you know what I mean? You can't just keep saying no on text, because it's too easy. And I know people in those situations, that's what they do. I did it when I sort of had the mental health issues and stuff. It was so easy just to click a no on a text or not even answer the text or the call. You know, but if somebody sat in your drive and they're pottering about and they're picking up your weeds and all that for an hour, it's kind of hard to get rid of them.
Well, I thought it was absolutely brilliant, Morsey. And as I say, I've always thought very highly of you anyway from my dealings with you. But the fact that you did that, as I say, that overtakes football. That's just life things and a friend and what a true friend is. I thought it was absolutely amazing. So fair play to you. And your pal, Davey Kennedy, I don't know him, but the fact that you mentioned him, we should give him a mention as well. You spoke there, Morsey, about obviously you had your own troubles and issues and stuff. Is it much easier? Like, we often hear about mental health now, and it's become very prevalent in the world, and thankfully more and more men, particularly men, are beginning to speak out about it and I suppose speak about the issues or whatever they have. Is it though much easier to, I suppose, help someone out if you've your own personal experiences of it, or can anybody help anyone out?
I think anybody can help anybody out. Listen, it helps if you've got some experience to fall back on. I know when I was really struggling, With my mental health in England, a friend of mine done something similar and showed up at a hotel for me and just sat outside the door. And I wanted to run a mile when I seen him in the corridor, you know. So I'd had sort of first-hand experience of somebody just showing up, and they're the last person you want to see. But no, when you look back on it, you think, you know what, that was the right thing to do for me. You know what I mean? He helped me a massive lot, just for me to see a friend, see a friendly face. We went and had a burger or whatever. We didn't. Just had a chat. I was in bits, like physically and mentally, I was in bits at the time. But he just came down for an hour, just said, right, we'll go for a burger or whatever. And that was it. So I think anybody can help. And I think you have to reach out to people and look after them. And I, from experience, like if you're talking about mental health and stuff like that, I would say like people who have opened up, you know what I mean? It's that's not the end of it as well, from experience. Opening up relieves a lot for a lot of people, well, especially men with egos and all the rest of it. But it's then that there will be kind of a relapse, I would say, a few months later. And I think it's for friends and stuff like that. It's making sure they keep on top of people and keep checking in on them, you know what I mean? We all say when somebody's passed away that we have to meet up more, we have to do this more and all the rest of it. But I think people in general in life probably need to make more of an effort with everybody.
Could you mind me asking you, Morsy, through your own troubles?
Ask me what you want.
Okay. through your troubles, because obviously we've read about them in different things, but for a lad who did so much in his career, professional footballer, achieved a lot, what was it that, I suppose, started off your issues, or was there anything that triggered it off, or can you even go back and remember what it was?
I was kind of had those thoughts when I was younger. I always remember wanting to drive into walls and stuff when I was younger.
Really?
And I wouldn't have said I particularly would have gone around and felt suicidal or whatever, but I had those thoughts quite a lot where I'd just be driving home and training and stuff at 17, 18.
I was going to say, at what age? 17, 18?
17, 18, and I wouldn't have said I had any sort of worries or anything like at that time, but there was obviously something in me that just wanted to get out of here for whatever reason it was. And I remember sat in a hotel with my mother, and I had a thing in my head that I wasn't going to live beyond 26. I had, for some reason, 26 was in my head. And I used to sit there and say, I won't be here after 26. I'll be gone.
And would you openly say this to your mum?
Yeah, I remember saying it. We were up with the 21s. I was sat up there with a couple of lads having a drink after one of the games. And I remember openly saying, I won't be here after 26. I'll be gone. And I was only probably 19, 20 at the time.
Would you have been in Ireland?
Or whatever it was.
This in Ireland, Al, before you went to England, or this growing up in
Finland? No. I remember it well, I was back for a 21s game, so, and there was like the awards nights and stuff like that. So it was probably just after I picked up one of the Irish underage awards or something like that. And I just had that sort of thing in me. And I, as I said, I wouldn't have said that I particularly felt depressed or anything like that. I didn't have days where I didn't want to get out of bed or whatever. I just had this thing in me head to say that, you know, I won't be here for much longer, so I'm going to make the most of what I am.
And what was the reaction, Morsy, of, you mentioned you'd say that openly, maybe in front of your mum or the other lads, the 21s or whoever. What was the reaction from them at the time? Would people just pass it off, or was
yeah,
there ever
listen,
concern?
You start having a drink and all the rest of them, people pass it off. Like mental health and all that stuff wasn't even a thing back then in those days, you know. It was just, I mean, our parents never had any issues with mental health and all the rest of it. They went to the pub or whatever, you know. I mean, they always found a different way. So it wasn't even a thing back then. But I always remembered it when I looked, you know, when I had my issues later on in life and thinking, well, this isn't the first time I've had these thoughts before.
Okay. You know, so
and you try and then retrace, you know, you go back over where they come from. And I've had counselling and stuff like that, which didn't really help or work for me at the time, because I wasn't ready to open up, to be fair, when I went in for the counselling. And stuff, but when I've looked back and stuff, that they've always been there. All these thoughts have been in there somewhere. So I would say for anybody, like if they are only little thoughts or whatever, go and see somebody, go and speak to somebody, and see if there is a reason for these here, so they don't manifest. So for when you get older and things get tough or whatever, and you then sort of think the other way, right? I need to check out here.
I was just going to ask you, Alan. I mean, through the process of counselling and you know, opening up to this and talking about it, have you been able to kind of maybe pinpoint something that you, like you're saying, you're pretty much saying you always had this self-destruct button. You always wanted to just press the self-destruct button. Regardless of what it was, there was just this button that you wanted to press. And you know, have you been able to identify what might have caused it, or do you just feel it was just always there?
I don't know why it was there when I was younger. There was a couple of things that I would have seen or whatever when I was growing up in the streets and stuff like that, because you're in Finglas, it was fairly rough and stuff like that. So
yeah,
they would have had an impact on me. But when I got older and when I sort of finished football and stuff like that, and I went to the council, and it was interesting that sort of, because when you're a kid, you live in the football world. All you want to do is play football, and you have a dream of playing for Ireland, and that's all there is. So that's all you live for. That's all I could remember in my childhood. I couldn't remember parties around it. I just remember the football, yeah, and wanting to play for Ireland, you know, Jack Charlton and all that stuff. So when I looked at it, like, basically I achieved all that at 21. Mm-hmm. So I'd achieved all my life's dreams at 21. And then I didn't have another go-to after that. So that ended up being a big problem later on in my life, that I had no purpose, because I'd achieved all my, anything I'd been brought up for, anything I'd live for, I'd achieved it fairly young. I'd played in the Premier League, I'd played for Ireland. So it was very, there's nobody there to tell you at the time, like, right, well, here's a new goal for you, here's a new challenge for you. Mm. Because it's subconsciously, I'd already achieved that. I'd set out. So by the time I got to 21, I think, well, what else is left for you in this life?
Can I throw something at you, Alan? Because I would guess you're aware of this, but because you're so modest, I don't know how your feelings are about it. But for people who don't know you, I'm going to remind them of who you were. Like, you were effectively the next Ryan Giggs. Mm. You are labelled the Irish Ryan Giggs. Like, and I remember you played for that famous Rivermount team, where so many quality players came out of. Everyone was talking about Alan Moore. Even when you look at some of the things that you were doing at an early, you know, when you went to Middlesbrough, like out of this world stuff. Did you sense that at all? Was that on your shoulders? Could that have been part of, could that even have accelerated how you were feeling? I mean, what kind of role did that play on your development?
It's interesting, because I was thinking about Steve McGuinness, you know, like, so we all have, like, I'll have a perception of you, Stewie, from on the pitch and stuff like that, and you, yeah, quotes and stuff like that, you know. So we all have this perception of our mates, of how they are in the changing rooms and how they are in the pitch and stuff. But that's football world. That's not like your real life. That isn't who you are.
Right.
You know, and again, I go back to that bubble. So football was always my release when I was playing. You know, I could express myself as a footballer differently to what, because I was very shy and quiet off the pitch. I barely spoke off the pitch. Mm. But when I got onto the pitch, that was my, like, it was like you, Stewie, singing a song and stuff like that. That was my stage.
Yeah,
that was right. Where I went and performed and stuff like that. So that was where I went and had my fun and stuff like that. So football was like a release for me and stuff. And that's what I'm saying, like, away from the pitch, you don't really get to know what's going on with people and stuff like that. Because for me, Steve McGuinness was our captain, was our leader, was our hard man. He was invincible. And then all of a sudden he's got cancer, and it's, that can't be our Steve. And that goes back to that ego, what he had and stuff like that. You know, so, but I said, we're all human. We've all got this other life. Football's only a small part of our life, I think.
Did you know?
But for me personally, football was my release. It was my theatre.
Around that time, Orsi, when you signed for Middlesbrough, which was obviously a big deal, you mentioned playing the Premier League. So I think, was it Lenny Lawrence? And then for the majority of the time would have been Brian Robson, who's a huge influential figure in the game, not just Middlesbrough manager at the time or whatever. Would you have ever spoken to him? Like, I know nowadays, as you says there, it's a lot more prevalent and people speak out. It wasn't the case as such back 20, 25 years ago. Would you have ever spoken to any managers or teammates around how you were feeling at the time?
Listen, I think back up, I nearly packed in football soon after maybe first team debut and stuff like that, because I was that homesick. I mean, that was the reason I came back and played for Shells. I couldn't wait to get home. So maybe that, like, had a massive impact on me, never being able to deal with being away and being away from all your close family and stuff like that, and your mates and stuff like that. So I actually went back when I was young. They said, Middlesbrough had done a brilliant thing with me when I was younger. They just said, listen, go back and spend some time with your mates. You come back when you're ready, book me a one-way flight. And I came back to Dublin after 4 days. I was bored silly because all my mates were either at college or they were in work. And I went, and that was like a restart for me. But I always had that. I wanted to get back to Ireland.
It's funny. I never knew this, and I never spoke. And I'm raging I didn't know, because I would have. When I went to Leeds, I suffered really bad the first year, and something similar like that, Morsy. they paid for 6 flights for us home as part of the contract.
Yeah.
So I think I went home 13 times in the first year. I just couldn't cope, couldn't settle, was coming home every 3 or 4 weeks. So it came to the stage where I packed my bags one night and I booked a flight, and all the other Irish lads that were there were saying, don't do this, you can't do this. I rang my dad on the night and he says, we have absolutely no problem with you coming home. We will support you. If you're not happy, come home, but don't just walk out. The club have been so good to you. Sleep on it. Go down to the office in the morning and tell them, look, I'm going home. This is not for me. I can't handle it. So I did that. I slept, went down the next morning, told Alan Hill, who was the youth development officer, and like that, they sent me home and says, look, Alan, you need to make a decision. Go home for 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, whatever it is. And like that, I went home. I think it was 3 weeks I stayed at home and then realised, look, I need to go and give this a shot and give it a go. But I never knew that about you, Morsey.
Yeah, listen, it's one of the big things, because I came back to England to be academy manager. So I was here academy manager for 5 years. So I had the 16 to 18 year old lads. And I took quite a few lads over from Ireland, from Joey's and stuff like that. And I just went off my experiences. And even I had lads, say, from Manchester to Leeds, who were staying in digs, would get homesick. And it was only like 45 minutes away. But they were still getting homesick. But because I'd had the experience, it was always something I looked out for, and always something I said, listen, get yourself home. Don't worry about it. There's nothing we can do. You know, and it was a massive thing for me to make sure that they were happy and where they were. But the homesickness was a massive thing with me. But as soon as they said, like, go home and all, I felt like I owed them. I thought, you've been too good to me here. I need to sort of prove to you. And like, I mean, they used to let me go up in the office on the phone nearly every day and stuff like that. But in Middlesbrough, you know, they were brilliant with the homesickness thing with me. So it was a big thing, and it still is, I think.
I was just about to say, Morsey, I don't know if people even realise, because the perception, I don't know if it was the same for you, but people used to nearly laugh at me, you know, think like, you're going over to a Premier League club, getting this opportunity, and you're crying down the phone. And I was crying down the phone numerous occasions. And it came to the stage, I'd say, it came to a head where I says, I'm going home, I've had enough of this. And I don't think people realise, Morsey, and I'm so glad you've brought this up, we haven't discussed this before on the show, but I don't think people realise just how hard it is to, and I don't know, is it because the Irish are homely and we're warm, kind of, your family so close to you, do an awful lot for you, the Irish mammy, all this kind of stuff. I don't know if it's a thing, but you mentioned it there even with English lads, but it's really tough in the game.
No, it's massive. It's massive, and especially when you're academy manager. Like, so we had, what the age we would have been, 16. So you're leaving school, you've never walked before. You don't know that you have to be there at certain times, and if you don't, you get sent home if you're a minute late for training and stuff like that. So you're learning all this stuff, like, and I know it, like, looking from academy manager's point of view, that I'm having to try and educate the lads on this, but they're so brand new, because they're just coming right out of school where they could do what they want, they can mess about, they might get detention and all the rest of it, and all of a sudden they're in the real world now, and it can be quite scary for a lot of the kids. And I'm on about, like, even the English kids, like, from Newcastle to Carlisle, it's only an hour away and stuff like that, who would struggle with the homesickness and stuff. But it's interesting, I spoke to Man U years ago, the head of recruitment there, and he actually said that the Irish lads were probably one of the most difficult to take in because of the close families and the big families that they had. He says that we're all the cousins and all the aunties and everybody wants a part of them and stuff when they come across. He says they're finding that the Irish lads at that time were really difficult to settle, you know, that they were the ones that they would have had to look out for more. So it is probably the culture and stuff that we are from.
I was going to ask there, Alan, and both of you actually, but I'll put it to you, Morsey, first. Like, you know, would you have felt pressure, and this could have been self-applied pressure, that I have to make something of this for my family? Like, you know, because you come from a working class background, you're a fingerless south. You know, this is the opportunity for I can fix my family with this. And is that something that would have weighed heavily on your shoulders?
Yeah. Listen, you come from having to get paper rounds to pay for your boots and all from the age of 11, because there's no money in the family and stuff like that. So I always knew that this was a way, you know. I was never ever sort of driven by money. I was never driven by money. I wanted to just play football. So I never really had an agent, never signed boot deals and stuff when I was younger. And every year I performed on the pitch and got a new contract. They just came and offered me a new contract, and I never really sort of questioned them around. I just wanted to play football, so the other stuff came with it, and I was able to sort of then send that home and help the family in ways that you wanted to do when you were younger. But for me personally, it was always about the just playing football. You know, the money would come after that. But certainly, I was driven, and that's probably why I ended up playing where I was, because I was driven, and I probably had the setback when I went back for a couple of days and thought, right, well, that's not happening again. Because, I mean, it's funny, there was a lad from Northern Ireland who was in the same digs as me, who left after a week because he wanted to go back for his girlfriend, and he was homesick, and he never came back. And that was kind of a nudge for me to say, well, he's just packed in his whole football career after a week. So that was kind of always in the back of my mind as well. That says, well, he left me in the digs by myself, because it should have been two Irish lads together. He left me in the digs by myself, and that made it harder for me, but it also drove me on as well, spurred me on. So internally, you know.
I wasn't driven.
No way. You're only telling me that now.
And but I'm very driven now, Stuart. And I had a girlfriend. And now I look back and think, what a fucking idiot I was. Because she's not the girlfriend she ever was going forward. But I don't mean that in a bad way. But and this is the thing. There's so many factors in it, Morrissey. It's really interesting. I've never spoken about this before. Even with Stewie's question there, I never felt pressured. It was just part of it was her, which I'll openly admit. And I often think it more so even with, you're on about, did you feel pressure to do well for your family? I always just felt more so just for me dad.
Yeah.
And when I didn't, to this day, I still look back and think, he would have loved me to play it.
I'm going to make him proud.
Yeah,
that's
now
normal,
I have in some ways gone, I don't know, but what I do know, but in terms of that was always just with him more so, because he was everywhere with me. Like, my mother wouldn't give a shite if I was washing dishes, you know, kind of. She had no interest in football, but dad was everywhere with me, and it was more so him I always felt. And the biggest thing that I always say to people about it, and I don't know if it was the case with you, Morrissey, and maybe it was the penny dropped with you, I never realised the opportunity I had. And purely because I was 15, 16, who does? A lot of it used to just come naturally. So the stuff I should have been working on, in terms, I was always, like, you know me, skinny and slight and wouldn't be aggressive maybe in off the ball and that kind of stuff. But the football side of it used to come easy, so I was never having to work on that. The stuff I should have been working on, I was never working on. And that's what came against me in the end.
I mean, I was driven. I mentioned it earlier there. I wanted to play for Ireland. So, like, Middlesbrough was a stepping stone for me just to get to Ireland.
Okay.
You know, and you're on about getting home 13 times a year. Like, I used to go back for the international games and stuff and that. So they were always my breaks. And I always played better for the youth team or whatever when I was 16, if I knew I was flying out after the game on that Saturday afternoon to get back for a game.
Wow.
I always had a spring in my step and stuff like that. I always remember that, you know, I had a spring in my step because I know I'm getting on that flight later.
It all points to one thing, doesn't it? If only we had an industry in this country for football, it would just solve so many problems. If you just think about it, like, now, if you think about Alan, if you could have played here at a high level at the age, you know, back in the early 70s, was it?
Yeah, it feels like that, by the way, when I try and get out of bed in the morning.
It's true, though. You think, like, it's only, here's me and Morrissey talking, but you think of all the Irish lads that have been away like that. And thankfully now, the way the landscape is, hopefully a lot more can stay. And if we do get structures in place, Stu, as you say, there is more of an opportunity for them. But back then, as you say, Morrissey, that was the only option on the table. Go to England, probably.
It was made to be everything, to be all and everything for us as kids. You know, you get yourself away and everybody in Finglas knew, like, the Derek Brazils and stuff like that, the Carrolls that had gone away to Liverpool, the Man U's when I was a kid, you know, so everybody knew who they were. So everybody was looking for them, the Ricky McAvoys and stuff like that, you know, so it was to be all and end all. Now, I look at the academy systems over here, you know, like, they're keeping kids now till 22 and 23. So they're not only developing them as sort of footballers, but they're actually developing them as humans to be able to cope with football and the demands of it, you know. So the support network around them over here now is magnificent for the young lads. And even though I'm talking about the English kids and the Irish kids, you know, so that they've got all the sports psychologists, they've got everybody, but they're actually giving them time to grow into people. Because you're talking, Alan, we were 16, 17, and you're making this life-changing decisions at 16, 17. You don't even know your arse from your elbow, to be fucking honest, at that age, you know what I mean?
It's so true.
Alan, do you look back at your career at all and say, do you know what, I made it? Like, do you have that sense? Because to me, you did make it. Mm. You did it, like, you know, and I, like, I mean,
you did it at 21.
I think again, I people wouldn't be aware of the Rivermount team that you would have come out of, but like there was like the Grogans, Manchester United, and they were nationally famous team, like, you know, you had the Paddy Hitter, famous home farm Paddy Hitter team, which was famous, but the Allen's Rivermount team was the same, like, you know. But from like you're the only one out of that era that for me made it, like, you know, and you look back and go like, yeah, you know, I got out. I mean, I hate to say it, I got out of Ireland, like, you know, but what I'm trying to say is like I made it, like, you know, and you've made a better life for yourself. Do you look back at it all, reflect on it with that sense of achievement? Because you should.
No, I don't. Listen, you know me. I don't. I think football is like just one part of your life. You know, as you get older, right. And I would even say that to the young lads now, sort of, who are devoting the whole life to playing football. It's only one part of your life, you know, and then you finish or whatever, 33, 34, and then you go on to the next part of your life. So, for all the young lads, you know, I definitely sort of advocate making sure you've got other stuff to do as well. And It is a very small part of your life, and it seems a long, long time ago now when I was playing football, because of how my world has changed and stuff like that with kids and stuff. So, that's what I would say to others. It is a small part, even though I do kind of occasionally see videos and stuff like that. Like, there's nothing really in my house around like that. I don't have stuff up about football and all the rest of it. It's a different part of my life now.
How do you reflect on your time at Middlesbrough? Because as I say, the Premier League kind of was just kicking off in those days, and Brian Robson comes in, and then there's the influx of the foreigners and all that kind of stuff. So how do you reflect on that time? I know you said at one stage, not long after you making your debut, you wanted to pack it in. But when things settled down a bit then for you, and you were, because I think it was 10 years we were at Middlesbrough in total.
Yeah, listen, the first four or five years, it was a massive sort of just climb. Everything was on the up for me. I just couldn't get enough of football. Every day there was like new superstars we were signing, and it was like you got your Paul Mersons, your Andy Townsends, your Ravinellis, Janinos, Emersons, all them coming in.
Gascoigne.
And it was just every day in training, you knew that there was a chance of another superstar coming in. So every day you had to challenge yourself, and you had to be on your game and stuff like that. So it was, when you look back and you think, it was like, it's probably mad to think that you had to be so focused just to stay alive in training, just to compete in training. Because if you didn't, you were showing up by these lads. But I never kind of felt sort of ability-wise and stuff that I was out of my depth. And then I kind of struggled then the last 3 or 4 years. I played 8 games in 4 years, 5 years with injuries. And that then sort of took a massive sort of toll on my whole body and stuff like that. And how you sort of view, because then getting out of bed and every day and stuff like that was a battle. So never mind being able to play football at the levels you were able to play at. You were battling just to get out of bed and stuff, and painkillers and stuff like that. So that's probably where it kind of soured a bit for me. But certainly the early days, it was a really enjoyable time. You know, we just, when you look back at the people that you played against and the players that you had in your team and stuff like that, and it was a sellout every week, and we were getting 25,000 for reserve games at one stage up at Middlesbrough. It was bizarre. It was just mad. But that's what football can do, you know, for towns and stuff like that. That's the beauty of the game. That's why we love it.
You're just reminding me now, because obviously me and Alan, we roomed together, like, you know, at Shell. So like, I was always taken by the Dyfeen and the painkillers. Fucking hell!
It's like a chemist.
Yeah, it's like something from Breaking Bad, like, you know. But you would have. You would have. Is he gone?
No.
Don't think you can cut that out. You would have spoken to me. You would have touched on some of the things that, like, probably you would have seen in the Middlesbrough team, like, you know, about regards the kind of culture towards, I suppose, maybe drink, but sort of the painkillers and all that kind of stuff. Was it hard to get away from, or was it always prevalent in the game?
It was hard to get right away from, because it was the culture that you... When I started playing football over there, if you look back at your team pictures, there was only 14 players on the team picture.
Right.
So you were getting rolled out game after game. And it was only probably when I came back to Shells and, like, Nutsy was there, and they kind of had a thing, well, listen, if you miss a game here and we have you for the next 3 or 4 weeks after it, it's not the end of the world. Whereas at Middlesbrough, when I first got into the squad, the mindset and the culture was that you got out on that pitch regardless of what shape you were in. You know, I remember having 5 injections in an ankle before a game, and the and when I went down to pitch, I couldn't even feel my ankle because I'd had that many injections in it and stuff. And that was just the norm, just to get through games.
That's incredible.
So, but like that's what I'm saying. If you look back at the old sort of early 90s team pitchers and stuff like that, there isn't many players on the pitcher. So that was to do with you for 40.
How many injections did Larry Byrne give you?
Larry kept missing. Kept putting them in the chair, putting them in the bleeding table and stuff like that.
Larry was like Mr. Miyagi. He used to clap his hands together and rub them and then put them on your hands.
Morsey, tell me this before we move on to the Middlesbrough stuff, because I just want to touch on the fact that obviously the Shelburne days, you did come home. But just the last thing you mentioned, and the names roll off the tongue here, but who was the one, I suppose, in the training sessions or in the games that you thought, wow, this fella's on another level?
For me, ability-wise, Paul Merson was up there, but I think Nick Barmby
Interesting.
Nick Barmby was my standout trainer. Every day was, and the stuff you learn from, like, he'd come from Tottenham, and that was like a massive club at the time, to Middlesbrough. And he was an England international at the time. He was big money, but the way he trained and how he went about sort of everything that he did was just phenomenal.
Great hair,
phenomenal.
Hadn't he?
Different levels.
I love hearing, and that's a name, like as you said, the names, you didn't even mention them in the first 5 or 6 that you rolled off. And then I love when somebody comes out with someone like that, because there's 2 players that stand out for me. One that I played with, and one that I played, that I went to watch one day, and it's along the same lines as Barmby, but I never really got the whole hype around this player, and I went to watch him live one day, and he blew me away. And when I think back of the career that he had, and he was an England regular, Darren Anderton was unreal.
Yeah,
super player, No, I mean, Nick Barmby was only with us for a season, but in that season, it was just how he went about everything. Is just, but his skill levels and fitness levels and everything were just phenomenal. It was just, he was relentless, you know. He wanted to be the best in the country at the time, and he was gearing for that.
And funny, obviously you saw him a close hand and we're dealing with him, Morsey, but you would never get that impression of someone really driven looking at him from the outside. He always seemed a bit like kind of quite laid back in the way he played, and wouldn't seem like really driven in terms of what you said there, trying to be the best in England.
No, listen, he would have been similar to me. I mean, I even remember him at times at Middlesbrough. He would have been similar where, like, when he stepped onto the football pitch, that was his theatre. Off the pitch, he was really quiet, really humble, really just very, just got on with his own stuff. But once he stepped out onto the training pitch and the football pitch, you couldn't get him off it. He was just totally obsessed with it. And you could see that was his happy place.
Mm.
You know, so that it probably, even the stuff off the pitch, I probably related to. And that's probably why I found myself watching him and training a lot of the time. You know, and that's when you know you're sort of in the company of absolute world-class players and stuff like that. You're stopping and training and watching him when you've got Janinos and stuff and that around them.
Wow, yeah, that's some compliment to give him. I know you're short on time and you've been great with your time, Morsey, but just out the last few bits, just the Shelburne stuff, you mentioned there, I suppose, from your early days and the homesickness stuff, you always had in your mind that you were coming home. So I suppose the move back to Shelburne was probably the obvious one, but how did that come about? Was that like a previous relationship with Pat or anything?
It came about probably a couple of years before I came back, and I think I'd met Pat in Dublin and stuff like that when I'd been back over, because we'd go to Rivermount stuff, things and all that. And I'd always sort of suggested to him that I was looking to come back. So I kind of met him early in the season, the English season. He flew into Manchester. We had a cup of coffee at the airport and then he flew straight back out. And it was literally a chat like, do you want to come back? And I went, yeah. And that was it. That was the deal done. So... The connection was there. I was never going to go anywhere else because I know Pat a long time, you know what I mean? And his father was our manager at Rivermount and stuff like that. So the link was there. And I had to feel comfortable where I was going, and I felt comfortable with that.
Did you think when you came back, because you had obviously gone through the years of the Premier League stuff, high-level clubs, we mentioned some of the managers, but to me, Pat was one of the best managers, one of the best in the country here. Did you always get the sense... had he been in a different country or a different league, would he have been at a different level altogether? And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way towards our league or Shelburne, but I always felt, that was back 2004, I always felt, even my dealings and still now with Pat, that he was ahead of his time.
Yeah, listen, he was definitely ahead of his time, and I think a lot of stuff, like you see how we used to deal with the European trips and all, you know, like with the
with the training and with the how this the week was scheduled and stuff like that. You know, like that's all ahead of its time of what other clubs would have been doing then. The, his vision for the academy at Shelbourne and all the rest of it and stuff like that. I find it mad when I look at managers, you know, and players. Sometimes it's just about finding the right club. I think if he had found a forward-thinking club at that time in England or wherever, he could have gone anywhere. He could have gone anywhere, and he could have like just kept going and going and going, you know. So maybe he just didn't find the right club when he went to Scotland and stuff like that. But listen, the league was much better for having him in it. And I think the league was very strong when I was there because there was a lot of full-time teams. We were full-time and it was very strong, you know. And that was a challenge as well when I came back, you know, because the standard was raising every week. You could see it with us in Cork and Derry and stuff like that, you know. So it was a good time to be back.
Was part of the deal that Pat told you that you'll have a free role and Stu, you'll do all the man-marking jobs?
Listen, you know, players, when I look... When I look back at your career and all that, and you think, you know, when I was academy manager and all, I've got so much respect for the people's, like, I played with a lad called Kevin Ball at Burnley. Couldn't kick the ball straight, couldn't kick it 10 yards in the fucking line, kept hitting the stands and ever. But him on the pitch winning the ball back and the fear that he put into opposition teams just being on the team sheet and all. And I look back in that, I would never have been able to play if he wasn't in the team. And it was the same with Nigel Pearson at Middlesbrough. Couldn't kick the ball. It was fucking hopeless in possession.
You saying Stewie kicking. Couldn't kick the ball?
So I don't know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Stop talking all quick.
Did you know, Morsi, that Valeron still goes to bed thinking about Stewie every night of the week? He's like, that fucker in Dublin wouldn't leave me alone.
I just send him a text message every night just to remind him.
That was the one thing I noticed when I came back. Like the likes of Stewie, and there was a few others. There was Owen Hearys and stuff like that, you know, and Ollie Cowles. They could have easily played in England for me, whether it was the club or whether it was... There was no reason for me when I seen them because the standard was so high. You know, Stewie covered every fucking blade of grass, could play off both feet. He was a proper buck. He could have made fucking millions in the game in England for me. But Owen as well, Ollie, you know, they're all top-class players. So for whatever reason, whether it's the wrong club at the wrong time with the wrong manager, I don't know, but certainly the standard for me really, really was impressive when I came back to Ireland.
For people who are coming to the live show, we're going to have a live feed of Valeron from Deportivo as well, when Stewie's singing. Morsi, as I say, you've been brilliant with your time. Just tell us what you're up to now, and in terms of, I suppose, the different things over the last recent few years, the mental health stuff and all, you're in a really good place. Very happy, you seem.
Yeah, listen, lockdown was brilliant for me. I know it was horrible for a lot of people, but in lockdown I decided to detox from all meds, so I came off all the medication I was on and just went walking and stuff like that because I couldn't do anything else, couldn't go to work. So that's been a couple of years now where I've kind of stayed away from the sleeping tablets, stayed away from the antidepressants and stuff like that. So lockdown personally has been good for me. And then work wise I'm still in football, the last 30 years still in full-time football. I do the opposition analysis, so I watch the team before we played them for Wigan, okay. Wigan Athletic. So I watched Wimbledon last night. I've got to watch more games today and do a report on them and then give it to the management tomorrow. So still in football, still that's all we know and it's in our blood. So it keeps me busy, keeps me occupied.
Brilliant. Well, I'm absolutely delighted to hear that. And it was great to have a chat with you, Morsi. And as I say, we were always very fond of you when we played here and a great player that you were. But even more so with the stuff that we heard about last week with Stephen and all. So we wish you all the best. We wish you very well. And the live show, you're on the panel. You're in.
I'm on the panel.
17th Brilliant. Of November.
You're more than welcome. Please come over.
No,
Al,
seriously,
you?
I mean that. Yeah.
That's around my birthday weekend. I always seem to be in Dublin around my birthday weekend.
So. Well, yeah, absolutely.
We'll be in touch.
Brilliant, lads. Brilliant, right. Lads. Good luck with it.
Thanks, Morsi. See you later,
pal. Bye-bye.
Brilliant, lads. Bye-bye.
That was brilliant, Stu. Great lad, Morsi, isn't he?
Oh, I love this guy. I loved him.
Did love him.
I did love him. I loved him. I actually remember Pat telling me he was signing Alan Moore, and I couldn't fucking believe it. I was going,
so tell us, you mentioned here, like what I wouldn't have known is that young underage, and I used to hear about the reports.
Alan was the Ryan Giggs.
He was that good.
He was that good. Everyone was talking about him. Okay. Said, there's this kid coming through.
That would have been the talk of Dublin.
He was the talk of Ireland. Okay. This lad is unbelievable. Like, you know, the new George Best. Like Alan was earmarked as the next George Best to come out of Ireland. He was that good. He was fucking unbelievable as a schoolboy, as a kid. Then he went to Middlesbrough, snapped him. I think he had a choice of
wherever he wanted.
I could have gone anywhere, like, you know. Went to Middlesbrough, and then he got injured. I remember we didn't touch on it there, like, and I remember Adam telling me, I used to ruin him, of course, but like they had to literally reduce his calves by half because he was getting this syndrome whereby his calves were too big and it was causing blood flow issues for him. And he spoke there about the numbness in his feet and all, like he would get that as well. So he had that operation to reduce his calves and just kind of always struggle with that kind of stuff. But ability wise, this fella is. Mm. I don't think anybody has come out of Ireland since with the same
reputation
and expectation that they had that the likes of Alan Moore, that Alan had, like, you know. And like, because if you think about the route Wes took, right? Mm. Wes had to go to Livingston.
Mm.
He had to get out of Ireland and he had to go to Livingston for like 30 grand and he had to make that route around and eventually people took notice. But with Alan, it was like, this fella is
going to
the
top.
Shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there was a lot of exposure and hype on him, like, you know. But like even when he was fit, and you look at some of the stuff that he did, it's fucking unbelievable.
I was brilliant.
Have a
look
back at some of the stuff on YouTube, Jesus.
But even when he came back and played with us, yeah, and that European run,
he was different level altogether.
And he used to stick out, yeah. But I loved it, even the chat, and he's a great lad. But moving on, Stu, this weekend, cup semi-finals. I love this time of year. I love the cup, as everybody knows, but I'm really looking forward to these two because I think it's wide open.
I can't call it, Al. Can't call it.
Normally, we obviously, the last few years covering the Cups, we've done, and of course you had Dundalk dominating and you had Cork for the couple of years and those two going at it, and then obviously Shamrock Rovers the last couple of years with Dundalk. But with the four teams that are left at the moment, and I know Dundalk is one of them, but it's not the Dundalk of old, but it's so wide open with the four teams. I'd say the four teams fancy their chances.
Nothing between them. If you had asked me 6 weeks ago, I'd have said Pats and Bowes. Mm. But now you look at the run of form that Waterford are on. They've just thumped Finn Harps under big pressure and they look like they might be hitting form again.
They've picked up 23 points out of the last 33.
Yeah, they're in real proper form. And then Dundalk, obviously, I think it was this time, it was a little bit earlier this time last year, back in September, where they kind of hit a bit of form. Like, and after the poor season they've had, I'd say the players are kind of looking, this is the chance to kind of redeem the pretty much the shit season that we've had, like, you know. So, and they've got an incredible record in the cups. They're going for the seventh final
which is
incredible. The only thing, if you want me to really put my Pats and Bowes, okay, pretty much, like, you know, kind of had that in my head for a while now. Thought it'd be a great final, but I'm just looking at the home draw, and I think that might just be enough to get both of them over the line. But genuinely, there's nothing between them.
Yeah, something similar with you. 6 weeks ago, I would have been very much in Bo's camp. They've been hit and miss over the last number of weeks. But I did think they were brilliant on Monday night in Tala. First half in particular. Missing Georgie Kelly as well. Ross Tierney. Yeah. I thought they were excellent. They probably should have went on and be kicking themselves that they didn't win. But I thought Shamrock Rovers, to be fair to them, going down to 10 men, they were brilliant in the second half. So a draw was probably a fair result overall in the end, maybe. But Bo's will be kicking themselves. But so if they take that form into the game Friday night and Georgie might be back and Ross Tierney, I would fancy them with the home advantage as well. And I would love to see maybe Bowes get to a final. The other one is trickier to call, I find, because Pats, Dundalk, as you say, have turned things around, but I've been really impressed with Stevie and the job he's done this year getting them into second. I thought they would have been just maybe challenging for Europe, but the fact that he has them a little bit higher and title challengers for a spell, I know it's tailed off. So, and I think if he was to get to a final on the back of finishing second, it'd be an unbelievably good season for them. So it's harder to call, and I'm kind of swaying towards Dundalk for some reason because of the recent form they've been on, but it's really difficult to call. But I'm really looking forward to the games.
Probably helps Pats that they're out of the league thing, right? So there's no expectation on them there, and obviously the game with Rovers a few weeks back put a nail in the coffin of that. They now have to focus on the cup, which might help them. But I agree with you. Like, you really can't split them. Like, sometimes Richmond doesn't suit Pats for certain games. You know, the tighter pitch, and they're a kind of team that you like. I mean, when we covered the first game of the season
up in Tala.
Up in Tala, Pats were awesome that night, especially that first half. Like, you know, so
with Robbie Benson, I think he'll be back as well. So that's a huge bonus because obviously Robbie missed the last few games. That'll be a big thing for them. And as you say, maybe yeah, the Dara Byrne's been excellent. So I'm not going to look. Whoever wins, good luck to them, because I like Stevie, and obviously the Dundalk thing has been great over the last number of years. So I'm not going to, for once, I'm going to sit on the fence. But I would like to see Bowes maybe come through the other one. So it'll be interesting to play out. I'm going to Daily Mount. Are you working?
I am in Daily Mount for Friday. Yeah,
I'm going down to Daily Mount. I'm bringing the wee man. I'm looking forward to it. Another, it's funny, we'll stay on the Bowes topic, because I mentioned the game on Monday night, Stu. Great game. I thought it was really, really good game. The sending off nearly helped Shamrock Rovers. It gave them a bit of a livener.
Yeah,
they were brilliant
so.
In the second half. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant in the second half. Fluky goal, I know. Bowes will be kicking themselves. But I thought it was a really, really good game overall. What's transpired since? Where do you stand on this? Like, Bowes obviously get a lot of plaudits for the off-the-field stuff and what they've done in the community. We've mentioned it over time. Of course, there's massive rivalry. Shamrock Rovers didn't allow Bowes fans into the game, and Bowes have come out since, says, we won't be letting ye in, despite restrictions lifting. Where do you stand on this?
I'm kind of split a little bit on it, you know. Obviously, Bowes, I was just kind of saying earlier, they're not passing the peace pipe around anymore. Like, you know, the magic mushrooms have worn off, because they seem to be rightly pissed with this. But I'm split on it, and I'll tell you why I'm split on it. Like, I can remember sometimes.
Is it just petty?
It looks petty. Mm. It looks petty, you know. But you know, sometimes in this game, you have to fight your corner. Like, a little bit like someone coming over to you in your face and going, "Would you ever go fuck off?" And you know, certain people will go, "Yeah, okay, I'll see you later." And other people go, "Do you know what? You can fuck off." Mm. Like, you know, they'll stand up for themselves. So that's what I'm kind of seeing is what's happening here. Like, you know, but ultimately, I think they look back at it and they're in the wrong. I think they need to kind of row back, and hopefully they will row back. I don't know whether they are or not. But we're not gonna have a Bowes and Rovers derby game in Daly Mount with.
No way, fans.
With the full complement of Bowes and Rovers fans, yeah, and a packed house, and I want to see that. I want to.
Because them games.
I want to finish the
electric.
Season. I want to finish the season with a Bowes and Rovers derby with them. I think, to be quite honest, I think the Bowes fans will miss them. Who are they going to fucking shout at?
And the players will probably miss them as well. You know, they say Bowes trying to.
Yeah, you need them. You need them in there, like, you know.
I thought my feeling on it was, when I saw it last night, I thought, because Shamrock Rovers should be letting away fans in, first of all. So go back to that point, first of all. They should have been letting the away fans in.
Do we know why they weren't letting
the
away fans
in? I don't know the full ins and outs. So maybe one of them might want to maybe clarify for us or whatever. So I'm not going to make any claims here in terms of maybe there's something in the background that we don't know about. But just my general feeling from looking in on the outside was let them in or whatever. But then you have, I thought Bowes then would just come out and rise above that. And not get kind of lulled into that tit for tat, because I think it makes them look worse now, because they're being the petty ones nearly.
Yeah, well, that's the optics of it, you know, and especially for it to come out on the day where the government effectively announced that the, you know, we're back to full capacity crowds. So it's a bit of a boo boo, like, you know. But look, all the moral people come out and say, you know what, it's wrong, and you know, for the good of the game, and look, ultimately that's where it goes. But part of me. I hate fucking admitting. Part of me kind of said, sometimes you have to kind of, you know, stand up for yourself a little bit. And there's rivalry there, and
big rivalry. If,
you know, you kind of how do I put this? Sometimes you need a little bit of needle in the game.
Oh, like, no, I love the needle in the game. Absolutely, yeah. I love that rivalry for what it is and stuff.
Unless it's a publicity stunt, they turn around 2 weeks ago, we're only messing.
I don't think it is, but anyway. Okay, Stu, that was episode 30, we think. But I really enjoyed that more. It was absolutely brilliant. You're working. I'll be looking forward to obviously hearing about the Cups next week, the semi-finals. We know who's in the final. And most importantly, the live show, 17th of November, people. We all know when it is now. We're going to have a great night.
What day is that?
Wednesday night. We're going to have a great night. Sugar Club, we want everyone to come along. We'll have good crack. But there's only one third of the tickets left. So get your tickets now, either on the link on in my bio on the social media channels or eventbrite.ie. And Stewie will be singing a cover, he told us. He might.
No, I'll do two songs. I'll do one of my songs, and I'll do a cover.
Brilliant.
A very unusual version of
it. You don't want to miss that, people. You don't want to miss that.
I don't know why I'm fucking doing this.
Brilliant. Okay, that was episode 30. Thanks a million for listening, folks. We will chat to you next week. And a big thanks to Benetti Menswear, as always, and Paul Morris, who looks after our buttons. Is that what it is?
Paul's, he looks our after producer. Our mental health.
And Paul will be there as well on the night. So we're looking forward to that, everybody. We will talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Cawley's Call, powered by Benetti Menswear. For more interviews like this, please subscribe to my podcast or follow on all my social media channels.